ladies and gentlemen. Today's opponents on Man versus Train. At the crossing, we have Rick, a 175-pound frustrated man who's running late for work. And on the tracks, we have Bull, a million-pound freight train that takes a mile to stop. Let's see who comes out on top.
You can't beat a train, so don't try. Stop. Trains can't. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
This is the No Long Twos podcast. I'm your host, Mike Savagno. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at No Long Twos and get all the latest content at nolongtwos.wordpress.com. Great news, we're now on iTunes. Follow us at No Long Twos, subscribe to the podcast, and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps. All aboard! Welcome to this week's edition of the No Long Twos podcast. As always, Mike Savagno here in the lab in Philadelphia with Jake Hurley.
Happy to be here yet again, as always. It's a short work week for me, so obviously happy about that. Not getting the chance to go home, but spending it in Philadelphia with my girlfriend and her family, so definitely excited for some good eats this week.
That it is. Thanksgiving week, we get a Thursday without basketball, which I always disagree with, but the NBA does have Christmas. We give football Thanksgiving, so good day to watch some football, some good games this week, and spend it with the family. But we wanted to come in this week and talk some NBA like usual. And the first thing I wanted to get to was Sunday night's ending of the Kings and Raptors game.
Yeah, so why don't you set the stage for us, Mike?
This is something that people have been talking about really all day on Twitter. So what happened was the Kings had the ball with 27 seconds left, according to most people, had a shot clock violation, but the clock showed 2.4 seconds left as opposed to 3.3, which people were questioning at the beginning. But the Raptors were down three, had a chance to tie. They ran out of bounds play. The ball was tipped by Boogie on the out of bounds play, so it wasn't a clean inbounds. However, the clock operator didn't start the clock. And so Terrence Ross picked up the ball, took one dribble left, made a very deep three that would have tied the game had it counted. But the NBA Replay Center in Secaucus went over this. I was watching it live. It probably took maybe 10 minutes real time for them to get the call right. They ran a timer and they said that it took 2.5 seconds instead of 2.4 for this all to transpire. So they waved it off and the Raptors, understandably, were furious.
Yeah, so the ending of that game is definitely pretty interesting, and kind of what it seemed like the defense of it was that they did a manual stopwatch and said it was 2.5 seconds, where there's obviously a huge room for error in that. And Dwayne Casey was definitely not happy with the explanation. After the game, the refs tried to explain it to him, and he said, well, if that's the explanation I got, he's like, I'm going to need another one, because it absolutely wasn't good enough for him. Raptors were obviously frustrated. It was a tough fought game. Second time this year, actually, that the Kings have managed to beat Toronto on a Sunday. But definitely a tough loss for the Raptors team after another tough night for DeMar DeRozan.
Kyle Lowry, after the game, said no comment to every question that he was given, and reporters finally left. Patrick Patterson fired off a series of tweets at the NBA looking for an apology. But I think in this situation, it's one of those things where you can't really determine whether or not Ross would have actually gotten the shot off had the clock started in time. You can hypothesize that based on what he did in the moment, it didn't, but it's also possible that he's playing the clock and he sees the clock and he gets the shot off. So when something like that happens, in my opinion, I'd like for them to just replay the play. Granted, it's not a perfect solution, but I think what happened to the Raptors last night was also extremely imperfect, because Ross can always go back and argue that he would have definitely got it off had the clock started on time. And I don't know what the fair solution is for either team, but in my opinion, replaying it at least gives us a chance to not have that happen.
Yeah, and it's something that we talked about earlier this afternoon. I definitely think that the call itself is very subjective, and there's no real right or wrong way. I mean, either way, you're going to have one team upset one way or the other if you make the definitive call right there. And I agree with you in saying that. I think the only real fair way to do it was to replay that, whether it was right or wrong, whether it changed the outcome of the game or not. Like, are the Raptors going to hit another 35-footer to tie the game? Probably not. But you at least like to see it play out that way as opposed to a 10-15-minute replay review and just have a lot of people upset on both sides. And I also like Kyle Lowry's quote saying that he was going to keep his mouth shut and save his money on this one, so he wasn't fined $25,000 for being probably pretty fairly critical of the refs in that game.
Yeah, maybe the Raptors should be fined for their fourth quarter performance. They turned it over 7 times. Toronto has, like you said, lost to the Kings twice now. DeMar DeRozan's only averaging 17 points a game this year against the Kings, 33 points a game against all other teams in the league. We've seen some regression from DeRozan recently. They've been on this longer road trip right now. They play tonight in a back-to-back against the Clippers, which will obviously be another tough game for them. It'll be interesting to see if they're able to hang with the Clippers tonight or if maybe that's one where they just kind of get the doors blown off of them.
Yeah, and so far this year, I mean, we've seen it in 2 games against the Kings. The Raptors have really struggled, especially DeMar DeRozan. It really seems like he struggles with guys with more length that are guarding him, in a guy like Rudy Gay, who is the predominant defender on him. They're both guys who actually like to work in the mid-range, so I'm sure Rudy Gay is familiar with how DeMar DeRozan likes to operate. I saw you tweeted out today DeRozan's real regression as far as his shots. He's not making as many shots as he was early in the year in the mid-range, and it's something that we talked about quite a bit. Obviously, he's very comfortable in that area, but you're not going to expect a guy to make 60% of his mid-range jumpers, especially a contested mid-range jumper like we've seen DeRozan take quite a few of this year.
Yeah, DeRozan also, once you get past how hot he's been on offense, he's really been a minus defensively both this year and really his entire career. And one thing that's actually tracking that, his defensive performance, is RPM, which ESPN released for the first time this week in season. Usually this is just a metric that comes out after the season, but ESPN decided that they're going to update it semi-frequently in season this year. So the rankings that came out are good as of the end of last week. Obviously, RPM is something that the ESPN people have told us fluctuates a lot in season, so we may not want to use it as, you know, significantly as something like VORP or PER or win shares per 48 or something like that. And it's really something that likes to track defense, I think, maybe more than some of the other stats. So you have to also keep that in mind. But I think that nonetheless, the first release of the RPM rankings was something that people were looking forward to and something that offers us some insight into how the season has gone so far.
Yeah, and like you said, RPM tends to be a little more defense heavy. That's not to say it doesn't favor players who have extremely offensive geared games, and that's pretty evident in the top five with at least the number two player on it. But the top five as of the release is number one, Chris Paul, number two, James Harden, number three, Jimmy Butler, number four, Kawhi Leonard, and then number five, LeBron James.
I think something that surprises me on this list, at least, is Jimmy Butler coming in as high as three. We talked about him a little bit on last week's pod, but I think that the Bulls are really riding Jimmy Butler right now. They're in the midst of their circus road trip. This is actually the last year of the circus trip, so the Bulls have struggled on this circus trip. Since 2009, they're 14-21 on the circus trip. The best they've ever done is 4-3. Right now, they're 3-1 on this circus trip. They have a game in Denver on Tuesday. They finish it up in Philadelphia, and this could be the best circus trip that the Bulls have ever had, largely because of Jimmy Butler.
Yeah, and Jimmy Butler's really shouldered that load in Chicago, and it's something that we talked about. He's obviously got great numbers when he plays without Wade or without Rondo, and that really hasn't been more evident than last night in Los Angeles against the Lakers, coming off a back-to-back. He was playing without Wade, and it's a game that he put up 40 points. I mean, Jimmy Butler is really proving to everyone in the league that he certainly belongs in the top 20 players in the league, if not even higher than that.
Yeah, Jimmy Butler was named the Eastern Conference Player of the Week this week, all due to his circus road trip numbers. He averaging 27-9-4 on 46% shooting, 37% from three, and he's getting to the line 10 times in the last four games. So this is a guy who's really playing well right now. He's top five in win shares per 48, RPM, VORP, box plus minus. He's sixth in PER. He has the highest gain in PER over any player from last year to this year. He's up 7 points in PER right now. Second in that is Lou Williams under Coach Luke. But you see that Jimmy Butler, in my opinion, has just continued to take leap after leap. He's already been the most improved player in the NBA once, and he looks even better this year.
Yeah, I think that the Bulls as a team and really Jimmy Butler as an individual are two things that we kind of underrated a bit going into the year. I mean, I know that I picked the Bulls to be my eighth seed, and that was kind of a surprise even to me when I was looking at it. But based on what we've seen this year from the Bulls, they are a very streaky team. They are somewhat talented. In 538 this year, they have them as a 96% chance as of right now to make the playoffs. I mean, granted, that's pretty earlier in the year, less than 15 games in for the Bulls. But they know what they do well. They're not a great shooting team. The pieces, again, kind of fit a little bit funny. But they're learning to play better without Rondo on the floor. They won a game last night, obviously, without Wade. He's not going to be an 82-game player anymore. But if he can play around 70 games, if Rondo can be an NBA league average player for 70 or so games, then they're going to be an all right team, especially in the East, which looks a little bit down this year. And I certainly like their chances to make the playoffs despite their poor shooting overall.
Yeah, and this circus road trip that the Bulls are finishing up this year brings me to, I think, a larger point about the NBA schedule right now. Looking ahead at this week of games, Portland is playing in Cleveland. It'll be the second night of a back-to-back. The first night of that back-to-back will be in New York. That's four games in 5 nights. It's the day before Thanksgiving, and the Cavs have been off, like we were saying, off the air for, what, 4 or 5 nights going into that game?
Yeah, so the Cavs haven't played since this past Saturday, and they're not going to play again until Wednesday against Portland. Obviously extremely well-rested, whereas Portland, on the other hand, is coming off just an absolutely brutal stretch.
That reminds me, too, of the fact that the Raptors had to play a brutal back-to-back in Cleveland at home against Golden State at the start of the road trip we just talked about. And so one of the things that the NBA has done this year, and I think that they acknowledge that they've done this, is that they're trying to backload the schedule because they now have 5 national TV nights per week after the NFL season concludes. And so a lot of these better teams aren't playing marquee matchups. I know last week we talked about the December 7th Clippers-Warriors matchup. That's probably the next Warriors game that people are excited about. Perhaps December 1st, Houston goes into Golden State, and so that might be one that we're now watching with how well Houston has played. But NBA.com and Sports Illustrated both did a ranking of top 25, top 50 games of the NBA season when the schedule was announced, and none of them are over the next really week, week and a half span. December 2nd, I believe, was the next one for SB Nation, and that's because LeBron is playing Dwayne Wade in Chicago and he has to wear a Cubs uniform. So what I'm saying here is that obviously we like the exposure that the NBA gets when they have all these national TV slots, but the schedule has kind of been heavily backloaded, and so we haven't seen as many premier matchups in the early season as we might want to.
Yeah, just in the first half of the year, we kind of see big West Coast juggernauts like the Clippers, like the Warriors, like the Spurs. They'll come east and they'll play teams like the Nets. They'll play teams like the Grizzlies. Really not marquee games. I mean, one of the most brutal back-to-backs, I think, is even worse than the Raptors, is the fact that the Brooklyn Nets have to play the Warriors and the Cavs back-to-back the week before Christmas, December 22nd and 23rd. I mean, the Nets, as it is, they're going to struggle to win a lot of games. They've had an easy schedule thus far, and then they just have to play the absolutely brutal back-to-back against two teams that were in the finals, clearly the two best teams in the NBA, just right before Christmas.
Yeah, I think that with this week, when you're looking ahead at games, you might be looking at Toronto at Houston on Wednesday. Granted, Toronto's going to be finishing up this long road trip day before Thanksgiving, like we talked about. Might be a time where Toronto players just kind of want to get out and be with their families. And so this is a tougher week, in my opinion, for kind of a measuring stick week where you're going to have teams that are good playing one another.
So we just talked about the top five in the recent release of the RPM rankings, but one guy who actually checked in at number 15 in those RPM rankings is a guy that we've been hoping to talk about the last couple of weeks, and that's Kristaps Porzingis of the New York Knicks.
Yeah, Kristaps Porzingis is a guy that's playing very well right now for the Knicks. I think that Jeff Hornacek came in. They had the big Noah signing this summer, you know, gave him a four-year deal, tons of money. And so he's slotting in Porzingis at that power forward spot next to Noah. Granted, last year Porzingis was even playing some small forward under former coach Kurt Rambis, who's now allegedly in charge of the defense. But KP at center is a lineup that Hornacek has been more willing to detonate in recent games. When I've been watching, it looks like he's starting maybe the second quarter. He's come out of halftime with that lineup every once in a while with Noah on the bench. And that lineup with Porzingis at center and Melo at power forward has a 22 net rating.
Yeah, and I really think that Porzingis has really come a long way in the development of his game, especially in the shooting just in his second year of the league. He's shooting 50% from the field this year, on 39% from three, and 77% from the line. He's a guy who a lot of people forget that he's 7'3". He's legitimately the tallest player in the NBA, tied with Boban Marjanovic of the Detroit Pistons. But it's really pretty incredible to watch Porzingis play. I mean, it's pretty evident watching the games that he probably has to play at center in the long term. Joakim Noah is not the guy he used to be. But when Porzingis is slotted in at center, even when he's slotted in at the four, he's really a dominant force for that Knicks offense. They're not playing the triangle as much as Phil Jackson probably hopes, probably just about where everyone else hopes they're playing. The triangle is pretty dated as far as offenses go. But Porzingis has really shown that he's maybe the Knicks' best player this year. In my opinion, I would probably put him at that spot, despite the fact that he's third on their team in usage rating behind Carmelo and behind Derrick Rose. But the guy really just kind of does it all. I mean, he's got 8 rebounds a game, basically, putting over 20 points a game, and just really a dominant force all the way around.
Yeah, he's also one of the best rim protectors in the league this year. Joakim Noah, in fact, is the third worst. And so that's another kind of evidence to show that maybe Porzingis should be as center, as you said. But he's improved really in all facets of his game. Last year, he shot 57% from the restricted area. He's up to 71% this year, which is well above league average. He's shooting better above the break, and he's taking less mid-range jumpers, which I think is important for him. When you look at his shot chart from last year, you see a lot of work in that low mid-range area, you know, short of the corner threes, essentially. And I don't think that that's a place, if you're going to be a featured guy in an offense, where you're going to catch the ball and you're going to be a threat for others. If you're catching the ball there, a lot of that's just kind of mid-post work where there's probably not a lot of cuts because you're unable to really throw the ball cross-court to open guys. And so that's essentially you facing up in more of a one-on-one isolation situation. And now we see Porzingis catching the ball either more on the blocks or extended beyond the three-point line. And so he's working more from those types of places that Houston is famous for working from. And I think that that's benefited his game this year as he continues to develop.
Yeah, I think the way that he's operating this year as opposed to last year is kind of what we see this year in Joel Embiid. He kind of catches the ball in that gray area. You're not really sure if he wants to face up or back down on the block. And I think that Porzingis has really become more in tune with where he should be. He knows his spots on the floor, where he can score most efficiently. And I really think that's been a big thing as far as the development of his game. And like you mentioned, his rim protection, he actually just started a campaign, hashtag Chris Stops, and he's going to be donating $500 for each block he gets the rest of the year. So I'd certainly like to see his rim protection go up even more from there.
He talked to us well today about how when he plays with Melo, he's more comfortable in terms of where he's receiving the ball. That, to me, as well as when you kind of watch him, may indicate that he's not yet ready to be that number one option. I think if he's going to be a guy that you run your offense through full time, his handle will probably have to improve as he's going to play on the perimeter. I think when you get smaller guys switched onto him, he's not really able to do much with his dribble. Granted, that's something that will come I think for him as he continues to develop within the NBA. But you like where he's catching the ball. I think he's playing well off of Melo. He's even playing well off of Derrick Rose. I mean, Derrick Rose isn't the best, you know, player anymore, but he does drive pretty frequently, which is getting Porzingis some open looks that he might not be getting otherwise. And so I think that the New York Knicks offense has really benefited him so far this year, and it's definitely possible that Jeff Hornacek continues to evolve his scheme.
Moving on from the upper half of the RPM rankings, we're going to move now to the very bottom of that list, and that's an Evan Turner who's playing for a team who's really kind of struggled lately, and in the words of Damian Lillard, they kind of suck right now, the Portland Trail Blazers.
The Blazers are 8-7, but they have the worst defense in the league. They're sending people to the free throw line more than any other team. They're bottom five in offensive and defensive rebounding. This is a team that, according to their margin of victory, should only be 6-9. They're 23rd in SRS, which is adjusted for strength of schedule. It's been rough lately without Al-Farouq Aminu.
Yeah, Al-Farouq Aminu, he's really their only solid defensive player that they have in their rotation. I mean, with the backcourt of Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, neither of those guys are known for their defense. Myers Leonard plays quite a bit for them. He can't really defend anyone. Alan Crabb comes off the bench for them, and he's obviously quite a bit of a sieve on defense. And then you have a guy like Evan Turner, who's really just absolutely terrible and just no justification for his contract this offseason.
Yeah, this is a team that has a 111 defensive rating without Al-Farouq Aminu in the past seven games, which would easily be worse in the league, worse than their overall defensive rating. Evan Turner and Damian Lillard together in the last seven games have an 89 offensive rating, which is 6 or 7 points below Sixers levels. Terrible. And so this is a team that is struggling to find ways to exist without Al-Farouq Aminu, despite spending $46 million on wings this summer. I thought it was ridiculous at the time. It continues to look more and more ridiculous when you lose a guy who's kind of a combo 3-4. He doesn't even score 10 points per game, but he's out of the lineup and suddenly everything's going just to shit.
Yeah, it's really pretty inexplicable what they've done this year. I mean, we saw Dame carry them earlier in the year. They're 4-0 this year in games where McCollum scores 30-plus points, but you can only score so much, and you still have to stop the other team defensively. And the Trailblazers really have not done that this year. They signed Azeele to be kind of their rim protector. He's not the answer there really either. Really, they're a team that's kind of like the Bulls of the West, where all the pieces kind of look good when you're kind of far away. But then you start to focus in a little bit more, and you're like, where does this make sense, and how is this supposed to work?
If I told you that Mo Harkless was going to be third on their team in scoring at 11.5 points per game before the year, you'd probably be thinking they're even worse than 8-7.
Yeah, absolutely. If Mo Harkless is your third leading scorer, then, again, that's probably a really big problem. He's not a guy who's known for scoring. He's really not a guy who's known for anything in the league. He's kind of been trying to find his place since they drafted him out of St. John's. He's a guy who's kind of bounce around. He's athletic. He kind of has some NBA tools, but you'd never expect him to be your third leading scorer. And if he is, yikes.
Damian Lillard is a guy who gets a lot of praise for his offense, but without Aminu and really the entire year, we've seen Lillard absolutely struggle to shut down opposing point guards. Lillard is a plus 17 per 100 possessions when Aminu is on the floor with him as opposed to when Aminu is out, but has the 8th worst defensive RPM of all point guards. Point guards against Portland this year have been absolutely feasting.
Yeah, so we have the numbers in front of us here just with a handful of point guards who have really absolutely tore up the Blazers this year. Drew Holiday, 21-7 on 11 shots in only 23 minutes, and that was one of his first games back from tending to his wife. James Harden had 26-12-14 on 17 shots, one of his handful of triple-doubles this year. Jerry and Grant for the Bulls, who, I mean, they've really struggled to get any production out of their guards this year. He had 15 points. Darren Collison had 25-4 on 16 shots. Then George Hill had 19 on 15 shots. And then do you want to talk a bit more about the other guys that we see on the list?
Emmanuel Mudiay, Chris Paul, and Eric Bledsoe have all had two shots at this defense. Mudiay has 29 points, Paul 46, Bledsoe 51. We've seen Mike Conley score 16, J.J. Barea score 23, and Steph Curry score 28. So when you look at the board, aside from their last game where they faced Isaiah Whitehead, who's obviously a rookie struggling point guard in Brooklyn, he only had 11 points, but almost every single point guard that they've faced this year has torched Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, whoever's been guarding them, and that's not a good sign for this team going forward.
Yeah, if you basically look at what the Clippers have done on defense this year, and then think of the exact opposite, that's pretty much what the Portland Trailblazers have done so far. I mean, they've just been absolutely torched by all point guards that they've played. They don't have a real presence on the inside. People can really shoot on them because they don't have any great wing presence, despite spending $46 million this offseason on their wings. So it's really tough to see how Portland's going to be successful the rest of the year. And you really hope that Terry Stotts can figure it out defensively. Obviously, the guy's great at drawing up X's and O's on offense, but maybe he needs a D coordinator like Kurt Rambis to cover the defense out there.
This is something that I think is potentially sustainable as well, because really when you look at Portland last year, they played well on defense for a month and a half. They had an easier stretch of schedule between January and the beginning of February. That's where they really made their push to get into the playoffs. They obviously were dealt a good hand in the playoffs when Chris Paul and Blake Griffin got hurt. Steph Curry was hurt for the beginning of their series against the Warriors, so there's a potential that the Blazers played above their heads last year because of all of those factors, and now we're kind of seeing this Blazers team without Aminu. They didn't have many significant injuries last year, struggle to lock people up, and if they're going to have to outscore every opponent, that's not going to be a sustainable model in this NBA. From Damian Lillard, an Adidas guy with a signature shoe, to big news out of Warrior World this week, Steph Curry's shoe is not selling and Under Armour is feeling the effects.
Yeah, I mean, we saw at the end of last year, obviously the Golden State Warriors blew a 3-1 lead. We've seen all the jokes on every corner of the internet. But really this year, the Warriors, for as much hype as they had coming into the year, you really honestly haven't heard about them as much as you probably would have expected so far this year. And really one guy that you haven't heard a ton about, as opposed to last year when everyone pretty much heralded him as the MVP within the first week of the season, is Steph Curry.
Last year the Curry 2s, I think, were really selling because of his younger fan base. I don't really know that many younger kids, but from reading Twitter and things like that, it seemed like every 10 to 15 year old was grabbing themselves a pair of Steph Curry's, but I don't think it was actually because of the shoes themselves. And then we see the Chef Curry's get released during the finals. Twitter absolutely explode, calling them the Shuffleboard 8s, whatever else, the Lawnmower 10s, anything that you can think of. And Curry then releases the 3s this year. They're once again, in my opinion, a terrible looking shoe. I don't think the colorways really work with many things. There's lots of aqua colorways and different weird iterations of them. And so it's not a surprise in my mind that the Curry 3s are not selling as a shoe.
Yeah, it's really no surprise to me either, and I know that we kind of think of ourselves a bit as sneaker guys, but the Curry shoes in general, since they very first came out, I really had no idea what they were trying to go with. I mean, they look more or less like a pretty plain Nike team type of shoe build, and then just kind of weird colors. I mean, obviously the Golden State blue and yellow is a pretty clean colorway, but for the most part, I mean, especially with the threes, they've thrown in the weird aqua colors like you said, and I really have no idea where they're going with this line. Steph Curry is obviously the face of their franchise, but if he's not going to be able to sell shoes like he did last year in his unanimous MVP season, you really kind of got to worry a little bit about Under Armour.
Now they have Kevin Durant as well, a Nike guy, so if you're a Warriors fan, you could buy the Durants. I think those are a better shoe. My opinion, the best shoes on the market right now are the Kyrie Irvings. I love my pair of Kyrie 1s. I'll probably buy a pair of Kyrie 3s. They just released the blue and white colorway that will be coming out in January. I thought those were pretty clean. We'll be willing to see what other colorways come out before I make any purchases. I think that Kobe always had strong shoes. Now that he's in retirement, it'll be interesting to see where that line goes. The Jordan 31s, I think, are pretty solid shoes. I know Russell Westbrook has been wearing those so far this year, but Steph Curry is really one of a few guys in the NBA that actually have a signature shoe. Damian Lillard, like we said before, I'm not a big fan of his either. I am excited for the Delly 1s to come out. Delly has been wearing that piece of tape over the Nike sign until his shoes are finally complete. So when we get the Delly 1s, those of you with grit, you might want to cop those, but Steph Curry's shoes have never really done it for me. Under Armour itself, I'm a big Nike guy, so Under Armour's not really doing it for me. And if Under Armour is this reliant on Steph Curry's shoes for their overall product, I think that that's a problem.
Yeah, and Steph Curry's probably the second most marketable player in the NBA today, behind only LeBron James. Obviously, LeBron has his signature shoe line. We mentioned a couple guys who have their signature shoe line. Kyrie, not as much of a marquee player as Steph Curry is, but he's really a marquee brand type of guy, and he proved with the Kyrie 1, so many guys in the NBA wear those shoes to play in. I myself have a pair of the double nickels after he dropped 55 in San Antonio. I know that we really like the Kyrie 2 and 3s. We weren't a huge fan of the big strap on the 2s. The 3s have kind of done away with that, so we definitely like where that's headed in that direction. I would certainly love to get a pair of the Delly 1s. I'm sick and tired of seeing the black piece of tape on Delly shoes. Just free Delly, come on.
I saw one game where it was going to overtime, I thought the strip of tape was going to fall off. I think we got to shout out Klay Thompson's Anta line as well, and Meta World Peace with his panda shoes from China. I think that those are a big hit in China. Not as much here, but really when you look at the signature shoe game, these are guys that are more marketable as players as opposed to shoes necessarily. I mean, Russell Westbrook doesn't even have a signature shoe. He might be one of the most marketable guys. Draymond Green at some point was rumored to maybe be getting a shoe. That hasn't happened yet. So signature shoes in the NBA are really reserved for the top tier guys. And Steph Curry's shoes not selling, not surprising to me.
And now for something completely different.
In the spirit of the holidays, as we said, Thanksgiving on Thursday, we wanted to get a little bit into our favorite foods on Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, probably the biggest food holiday of all of them. We're big eaters, and so we wanted to go with our top three Thanksgiving dishes, and then one Thanksgiving dish that we'd like to fade.
And this is something that we actually have not talked about previously. With most of the topics that we talk about, we'll text throughout the day, jot some notes down, go back and forth a little bit. So this is actually a complete surprise to both of us. So let's see what we got.
For my first food that I'm buying, I have to go with my mom's sweet potato casserole. She makes candied sweet potatoes. They're delicious. Put some marshmallows, some brown sugar in there. Shout out to my mom. Best Thanksgiving side.
I'm a big sweets guy myself, and I actually have a sweets later on. But my number one Thanksgiving dish, definitely the staple of all Thanksgiving meals, turkey. Absolutely turkey. It could be light meat, dark meat, doesn't matter. All turkey matters. Big turkey guy.
My second food that I'm going with here, pumpkin pie. I know you talked about sweets. We're getting right to the desserts. My dad's a huge pumpkin pie guy. I'm a huge pumpkin pie guy. Throw the whipped cream on there. Pumpkin pie, the only dessert, in my opinion, that you can go with on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I know the Emperor is a big sweets guy like myself. I actually have pumpkin pie as my number three, slash apple pie, because, again, big sweets guy. I kind of throw those in together. Actually, within the past, 2 years, I really started to try pumpkin pie. I really put myself out there. Big pumpkin pie guy now. I know that might come as a bit of a surprise to some people. But my number two dish, and this might throw people a little curveball, is actually gravy. Not a dish itself.
Is it a sauce or is it a spread?
It's real versatile. You can put it on turkey. You can put it on mashed potatoes. You can put it on stuffing. We'll get to that a bit in a second. But you can really do anything with gravy.
My entire plate is almost covered with gravy on every Thanksgiving. Granted, I, kind of keep the cranberry sauce off to the side, but gravy, huge addition. Wasn't thinking about it. That's a good one. My third, and you're not going to like this, it is stuffing.
Oh, God.
I'm a big stuffing guy recently. I don't know what got into me. Mashed potatoes could also be in that top tier for me, but I actually do pile the stuffing on my plate. That might be weird. People might not like that.
Yeah, I would absolutely fade stuffing myself. That's my absolute bottom dish as far as Thanksgiving dishes go. I mean, I don't love green bean casserole or anything along those lines, but
I feel like if you have green bean casserole in your household, that's a problem in and of itself.
Yeah, it most likely is. But stuffing is definitely at the very bottom of my list. Never really liked it. Way too dry. As much like gravy as you want to put on it, doesn't really make it much better. Granted, I'll eat it just because I feel like it's socially unacceptable to not eat stuffing on Thanksgiving. There's really no other time to eat stuffing. So if I'm going to eat it one day out of 365, I might as well do it. But I'm definitely fading stuffing. However, breaking news, I am going to my girlfriend's grandparents' house this year. Supposedly, their stuffing will completely change my mind, so I will definitely get back to you on our next episode, and I will let you know what I think of stuffing at that point.
Food I'm fading, this is going to come as a big shocker, turkey.
Wow.
I do not like turkey on Thanksgiving. I feel like I eat turkey way too often, so when I get my plate on Thanksgiving, I'm going small heap of turkey, and then everything else you're really piling up. As you said, things like stuffing, I'm not getting that every day. I'm not going to eat cranberry sauce when I come home, but I'll always have a turkey sandwich ready to go. So turkey, I don't know, maybe just little tiny bit of it for me.
See, I'm all about the turkey. I'll pile it on if I get 1, 2, 3 plates. Turkey's definitely going to be a staple in that. Take a nice little cat nap after that with all the tryptophan in it. Big fan of how sleepy and groggy I feel after eating a whole lot of turkey. Actually, usually when I eat at my parents' house, I'll rip the turkey leg off before we start the meal while my dad's cutting the turkey. Just eat that. Just go right into it. No silverware, no plate, just right into the leg.
It's real savage.
Yeah, it might be a real pre-crime move on my part, but I'm kind of okay with that. As I said, big turkey guy. Thanksgiving, far and away the number one meal day of the year. Nothing else really comes close, but really hope everyone enjoys their Thanksgiving this year with their family. I know I'm not personally going home for it, but for everyone who is, safe travels to you. Happy Thanksgiving to all you and all your family, and thank you for listening to us, as always.
Echoing Jake, happy Thanksgiving to everyone. I'm going home for Thanksgiving. I'm going to win myself another bowling championship. Our family always goes bowling on Thanksgiving nights, so I'll be taking that home for probably the third year in a row. Thanks again to everyone for listening, tuning in this week, subscribing, rating us on iTunes, everything like that. We won't be coming to you on Friday, obviously, because of the holiday, so enjoy that. Enjoy football if you have to. And we will be back with you next week.
And don't go Black Friday shopping early in the morning. That's psychotic. You can shop online for absolutely anything. Spend time with your families. Safe travels. And have a good one, everyone.
Trust the process. It's PTI.
Elfgard than my elven magic. Just as there's more to Geico than saving you money, Geico also gives you 24/7 access to licensed agents online, on the phone, or on the Geico app. And while I am a mighty elf queen, I am also a mighty big fan of barbecue potato chips. Minions! More smoky mesquite.
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.